signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is behind the controls. On today's program, Anarchy. Anarchy in print. We'll be talking to Sunfrog, who is part of the editorial collective for the quarterly Journal of Anarchism, Fifth Estate. And we'll also catch up on what's going on in our media environment, including some changes on the local FM dial. In Media Geek News, you'll want to stay tuned. In Media Geek News, we try to bring to light stories about our communications environment that typically go uncovered in the electronic media and get buried in the business pages of our print media. Stories about regulation, about financial dealings, about all these media companies are of importance to all of us, though, we think, especially if we're going to reshape our media to serve our needs in a more democratic environment. This week, internet radio webcasters told the House Judiciary Internet and Intellectual Property Subcommittee that burdensome copyright rules are forcing radio stations off the internet instead of encouraging them. Under current licensing terms imposed through arbitration by the Copyright Office, internet broadcasters are required to pay a royalty fee to record labels for each song broadcast. The recording industry does not charge a fee for songs played over traditional over-the-air radio. The National Association of Broadcasters offered Congress a five-point plan for reform, including provisions to exempt the sound recording fee for streams serving a station's local over-the-air audience, and to ensure that the current reporting and record-keeping requirements do not preclude broadcasters from streaming. The recording industry countered that new technologies are making piracy easier, and what's needed is legislation requiring a broadcast flag for internet broadcasts, encryption, or other digital rights management.
Yeah, they're always trying to regulate those digital technologies, aren't they? On June 30th, Saga Communications officially took over another radio station in the Champaign-Urbana area. The station, residing at 99.1 FM on the dial, is licensed to the city of Danville. Formerly known by call letters WIAI, Saga changed the station's call to WXTT, targeting its programming at the more lucrative Champaign-Urbana market, in addition to the smaller Danville radio market. In radio jargon, a station licensed to a smaller city near a bigger one that targets its programming to larger cities is called a rimshot. This phenomenon is very common in metro areas like Chicago, but we've also seen it grow in the last 10 years in east central Illinois, where stations licensed to smaller towns in the area, such as Rantoul, Mahomet, and Tuscola, focus their attention on advertisers and listeners in Champaign-Urbana. The addition of WXTT gives Saga a total of four stations in the Champaign-Urbana area, including 92.5 FM WKIO, 94.5 FM WLRW, and 100.3 FM WIXY. The FCC rules for defining the size of a radio market are in flux, therefore it's difficult to say with certainty what the maximum number of stations is that one owner may own in Champaign-Urbana. However, up to now, the effective limit in our local market has been four stations and is not likely to change anytime soon. So, you know, I was trolling around on the internet, and I noticed that that they'd changed formats on this station, but I didn't realize that Saga had actually bought it. How did you find out about this?
Well, one word or two words, FCC database.
I see.
So every so often, especially when I see a change in the format, I actually got this postcard in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're direct mailing everybody in the area about it, and I thought I'd look into it and saw that when I look into the record in the FCC database, that indeed Saga took ownership, at least according to the FCC, on June 30th.
But this is not a place that most media consumers are likely to go for their information, is it?
No, this sort of thing sometimes gets announced. I would say the times when I've noticed it in our local newspapers or elsewhere is when the companies themselves put out a press release. That's usually what triggers this sort of thing. Because, you know, when you're a media company like Saga, which is a relatively large media company owning stations all over the Midwest based out of Michigan, you know, when it comes to your investors, you want them to know you're buying lots of new stations and creating lots of value in that. And you tend to put out a press release. And Saga recently put out a press release for a couple stations it bought in Iowa. But no, they did not make a big splash with this. They seem to be, and I would say it probably has more to do with the advertising market than anything else, or trying, you know, than it does with trying to sneak one in or anything like that. But I noticed that, you know, they announced the format through a direct mailing campaign, which is relatively expensive. Yeah. And that's something that radio stations do too often because it is so expensive. You know, and of course, focus it on changing into format. And in fact, didn't even focus on a change, just focus there's a new station in town, which it is, since the station had historically been there to serve Danville. Although it's had two formats within the last 5 years. It was country music for a very long time and was always trounced in the ratings by WIXY, which is 100.3 FM, also a Saga station, and currently the market leader in ratings. But kind of had always some service to Danville as a local station. And then it flipped over to a kind of a classic rock format for the last year or so, and definitely set its marketing sights on Champaign-Urbana. And when I say marketing sites, I mean they're actively trying to get listeners, so marketing to listeners in Champaign-Urbana, also trying to actively get Champaign-Urbana advertisers. Being that Danville is not a very economically vital area at the moment.
So does this mean did they actually go through any increase in power, or is it just the same license?
Same license, same transmitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're keeping the studios in Danville or whether they're moving the studio to Champaign-Urbana. These days, clusters, when a company owns more than one station, they typically house them all in one area because they are typically run on some sort of automation system. I've only listened to stations sporadically. I didn't hear any live announcers. Doesn't mean there aren't any. I don't want to go out and say that. But it'd been very easy for them to just simply, all they do is put up basically a microwave link. But the transmitter itself would have to be in Danville. The studios can be anywhere.
That's the license rule.
That's the license rule. But you know, we mentioned in this headline, this rimshot thing, and we've seen a steady erosion of radio stations to serve smaller communities. And there's a reason historically why these stations were licensed to places like Rantoul, Mahomet, or Mattoon Charleston's far away from here, or Danville, in that it was believed by the federal authorities who allocated these frequencies that these smaller areas, these towns and cities, should have local service radio for things like local news, weather emergencies, and all the things you think a local station should do. And this is steadily eroded over the course of 20 years, especially since the Reagan era, when the sort of lessening of rules over all types of broadcasting went down. And so we see that all these stations, and they continue to broadcast, but they really focus their efforts on Champaign-Urbana. And so, you know, one particular station, WCZQ, out of Monticello, which is far enough away from Champaign-Urbana that the signal doesn't even come in very well here, has focused a lot of marketing attention on Champaign-Urbana. In fact, I see them in Campus Town, in front of like Follett's, handing out flyers, handing out free promotional merchandise, because they went from being a local country station, and we mean really local, like the kind of station that ran, you know, the trader shop on the air. You're like, hey, I got 50 pounds of dirt, and someone wants it. You know, you call me up at this number. I mean, truly local radio of a very older sort. Got bought by a different company, and now focus all their marketing attention on both Decatur and to Champaign-Urbana, doing mostly urban R&B rap programming. And anyone who's been to Monticello knows there's probably not a huge market for that music in Monticello, I'd say. However, probably a very underserved market for it in both Decatur and in Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. But the station no longer really serves Monticello at all, you know, even though that is where it's ostensibly licensed. And a lot of the stations which we think of Champaign-Urbana stations are not licensed to either city. They're licensed to Mahomet, Rantoul, Tuscola, and surrounding areas like that. And this is just another step, although you know, Danville is, comparatively speaking, one of the largest cities in East Central Illinois. You know, smaller than Champaign-Urbana, but larger than Rantoul, you know, larger than Mahomet, or larger than St. Joseph, and lots of other places. And so you're seeing now even a steady erosion of broadcasting focused on Danville.
Because it's a small city, and there's just not as much money.
Not as much money to be made, and if the signal will go into Champaign-Urbana, which 91.9.1 does quite well, then that's where they're going to focus their efforts. And Saga's probably, at this point, working on ways to sell advertising packages, because their four stations are relatively close together, except for the country station. They all play some form of modern pop and rock music, right?
Right.
So it's easy to sell advertising packages and saying, well, okay, you know, 99.1 may not be such a value on its own to buy ads, but we'll sell you a package where you get them across Oldies 92, Mix 94.5, and across 99.1, and we'll cut you a deal. And so that's why, in many ways, one frequency like that in Danville can be much more valuable to, say, Saga in terms of them upping their profits than it is for some single buyer to come out and buy it and decide to run a station on Danville. And I think we got a moment or two left. I see you've got one last headline to read there, Drew.
Okay. The presidents and CEOs of the nation's major public broadcasting...
I actually was going to have you read the other one.
Oh.
About the MoveOn.
The MoveOn one. Oh. Well, I can read that one, too. Well, the online activist network, MoveOn.org, has once again suggested and helped organize a round of house parties to be held across the country this weekend, specifically Sunday. The parties will feature a new documentary by producer and director Robert Greenwald called Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. Greenwald is also the producer and director of Uncovered, The Whole Truth About the War in Iraq, the feature movie of MoveOn's previous house party campaign. This is from the Outfoxed.org website. Outfoxed examines how media empires led by Rupert Murdoch's Fox News have been running a race to the bottom in television news. This film provides an in-depth look at Fox News and the dangers of ever-enlarging corporations taking control of the public's right to know. The film explores Murdoch's burgeoning kingdom and the impact on society when a broad swath of media is controlled by one person. End quote. It seems essentially picks apart the Fox News agenda of cheerleading for the Bush administration. Most with a bit of media savvy are already aware of this, but the film does point out some pretty grotesque examples of this. And I thought this was interesting. You know, MoveOn has done this before, and they're doing it again, that they're bringing networks of people together actually in small communities, in a house, in an effort to engage in discourse about this problem.
Well, and it's much less expensive and overall politically and it's much less politically difficult than trying to get theater distribution.
Right.
I think what's very interesting about Fox, of course, is that they've used hours and hours of Fox footage right off Fox News without their permission. And the filmmaker assembled a legal team, including Lawrence Lessig, who's become a very prominent law professor regarding elements of intellectual property and copyright, to help defend him, to say that they're doing this under the spirit and to their extent, and to their belief, the letter of fair use, because they're using this for critique, not to resell Fox footage, but to use it for their own purposes. So far, Fox has not chosen to sue them, but they're probably a little skittish after trying to sue Al Franken over his hijacking of Fair and Balanced. Mm-hmm. And I know that I heard that on Monday, in fact, MoveOn intends to file suit against Fox, challenging the veracity of their tagline "Fair and Balanced," which
really?
You would do so under federal trade regulations. Are there any screenings in town? Do you know any house
yes,
parties?
Yes, I know there's one on campus. Actually, it's at the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences.
Right, it's
organizing
the corner
one.
Of 5th and Daniel. I don't know what time it is though.
It's at 7.
It's at 7.
No,
p.m.
I take that back. It starts at 6.
So I bet you if you just showed up to the school, there'll be signs there.
I'm sure there will
be,
yeah.
It's on the corner of 5th and Daniel in Campus Town.
You're interested in seeing this, you know. So, I mean, I know MoveOn also, I thought this was sort of an interesting, MoveOn also has sort of its own history of cheerleading for the Democrats,
right.
the Democratic Party, but at least I thought that they're trying to move people in an effort of discussion, because, I mean, there could be some Fox supporter that shows up to this and said, I think y'all are a bunch of idiots, and this is the way it should be, and, you know, and you'd have a discussion about that, at least, you know.
Or someone who doesn't like Democrats either.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, we'll be
who
back.
Who could that be?
You're listening to Media Geek. We'll be back in just a moment with some talk about anarchy.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know that I have always tried to be honest with you. So I need to tell you something. I need to tell you today that part of what you have heard and read in the past week is correct. I am addicted to prescription pain medication.
Once again, our friend Rush creeps into the studio. He must have gotten ticked about us talking about Fox in such unglowing terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was at the LA Media Conference a few weeks ago, and I've been slowly rolling out some interviews I did there because there's a chance to meet with lots of very interesting independent media makers. And one publication that's been around going back into the 1960s is one called Fifth Estate, which has covered anarchist politics and also anarchist practice. And so let's go right in, and we'll hear from one of the editorial collective. So I'm talking with Sunfrog, who works with the collective that puts out Fifth Estate magazine. Is it what you call a magazine?
Magazine, journal. Even in the day, we called it a newspaper because we were in the tabloid format, and we were part of the original underground press movement circa 1965 through 1975, when we had pickup boxes in the city where people could pick it up like they would their daily paper. It was distributed in a more kind of wide, grassroots way. Today, we rely more on readers that know Fifth Estate and perhaps subscribe to it or pick it up at like an info shop or a radical bookstore. But yeah, magazine works.
Okay, and so how would you describe Fifth Estate?
Well, I think what distinguishes us is that we're anti-authoritarian and that we apply an anti-authoritarian or an anti-state analysis to just about anything that we do. And we are a mixture of artwork, theoretical, analytical articles, and reports and action updates and things, and also things that are announcing or promoting or advocating for upcoming future events, you know, for example, such as the Republican National Convention late this summer in New York City, or if there's an anti-war event, or perhaps in the Southeast or in the Midwest where we have our sort of base, which is in Detroit and in Tennessee, if there's local activity that we really want to feature or talk about, we'll write articles discussing local activities.
So what kind of activities are you talking about when you say?
We've often wanted to see ourselves as not being divorced from the world in which we live, the practices in daily life where people are trying to actually live out anarchist or anti-authoritarian critique. So, for example, intentional communities, collectives, co-ops, worker-owned co-ops, info shop spaces, for example, like a new one beginning in Nashville called the Firebrand, would be a media center and an info shop, a library, a show space, very reminiscent of a project that some of the FE members in Detroit did in the early 90s called 404 Willis, which was like a storefront community center. So being that we're not a political organization, we're not part of any federation, we're not really organizationalist or platformist or anything like that. So we're just a collective of friends, a group of people that have come together to put out the magazine, and we're not even incorporated. We're an unincorporated anti-profit thing that's very small and very informal in a way. So we want to show the manifestation, the translation of some of our ideas into everyday life. So, you know, whether it's a protest or a community center, I think it's really important to show that people are attempting to live out these ideals, and it's not just a theoretical notion.
Now, you did use the word anarchist, which I think is very commonly misunderstood and misused.
Anarchy is the noun that describes a state of existence without government, and also a state that in history has been one of incredible cooperation and imagination. And I'm thinking of even pre-state societies that go back thousands of years. Now, the common pejorative idea of anarchy is a sort of violent chaos. But in fact, the violence that people ascribe in the mainstream pejorative sense to the word anarchy is actually the nature of the state. The state's function is to use violence to enforce laws, to protect private property. So this notion that anarchy is chaos and anarchy is violence, I mean, the state is chaos. The state is warfare. Now, of course, there's also people who believe that, in the chaos, science, and therefore might see anarchy as sort of a metaphysical concept, and that's completely different. But in the mainstream sense, people think anarchy, they think lawlessness, they think violence, they think terrorism. And when I invoke anarchism or anarchy, I'm thinking of nothing of the sort. I'm thinking of it in the sense that it's a political philosophy, that human beings are fully capable of controlling their own lives without intervention from states, corporations, preachers, bosses, teachers, and so on.
And so as a publication, I note that when I look into the, you know, where normally a lot of magazines would have this whole list of editors and sub-editors in chief and everything else, you don't have any such list of people there.
There's, when you look in our staff box, it just says Editorial Collective North, Editorial Collective South. We do sign our work. Some of us use our legal names. Some of us use our chosen nicknames and pseudonyms. Some of us use pseudonyms that look like just generic, you know, John Doe type names. Some people use more flavorful and colorful and creative pseudonyms. We're de-emphasizing the role of the individual in terms of the way the ideas are presented. A lot of times our bylines will come at the end of an article. Of course, sometimes we print somebody like Derek Jensen, who is a brilliant writer and person who's been a strong advocate of the anti-civilization perspective, who's been really critical of the way in which the values of the society hurt us at every level, and he really deals with that on an emotional and personal as well as a political level. And when he writes for us, sure, we'll put his name there because people recognize his name and they want to read his work. Might be the case with someone like Hakeem Bey or Peter Lamborn Wilson. But by and large, we're not about promoting the cult of the writer or the individual author, but really rather the ideas. And there was a period in the 1980s when some publications would completely do away with the byline entirely and have just every article would be signed by the same pseudonym, even though maybe the articles were written by different people. It was very popular in the 1980s for people to sign their work Karen Elliott being a generic pseudonym that a bunch of people took on during that period, because it really challenges sort of this cult of personality and individuality, which is so pervasive in this society, the cult of celebrity, the idea that, you know, personal ambition is unto itself the reason for engaging in the kind of media work that we do. And, of course, the reason we engage in media work is to agitate and advocate for a transformation of a social system that we believe is inherently cruel and unjust. And so it's really not about us as individuals, but rather about pursuing the great ideals of anarchism that we, you know, that we espouse.
And so how does it get decided what goes into the magazine?
Many different groups function differently, and there are different individuals within the collective, myself included, as who have a more key, central, kind of what I call bottom-line role, meaning that at the end of the day, some of us will be there doing the work that makes sure that the publication comes out on a quarterly schedule, and we publish fairly routinely at March, June, September, and December with a seasonal schedule, a quarterly schedule. And so there are individuals also working with me in the collective that are more deeply involved. And there's probably about 3 or 4 or 5 other editors that with me are more core members. And then we probably have another 4 to a dozen members on the periphery. And so anyone can propose an article. Anyone can write an article, and then that article will go through a discussion list that functions best online right now simply because we're geographically dispersed all over the continent. And so an article will get discussed, and people will start to weigh in, yes, no, maybe. And usually that's what it will take. It'll be a yes, a no, maybe with revisions, and people will start offering suggestions. And then our writers will get feedback and usually do at least a second draft before we go to publication. And then at the point of final editing, we will edit for space and for technique and style. We'll do a modest edit of most people's work at that point for language. Now, any collective member who's actively involved in the collective could veto an article. And that happens from time to time where one person will just say, there's no way I'm comfortable with this going in. And if you're actively involved in the collective, you have that right. We try not to overuse or abuse that right to veto because it can create some antagonism within the collective. But by and large, we'll come to a fairly general consensus fairly quickly on a piece. And there's vigorous discussion of issues, but there's not usually that much of a contentiousness about whether an article should or should not go in, but occasionally that does occur, and that's part of what, you know, being a collectively edited publication is about, is having that lively back and forth.
So it sounds like you really emphasize collaboration and cooperation. Those are key elements right there between everyone, including the writers, who I think in other publications, especially mainstream publications, are very used to having their work altered and changed quite without their involvement or permission.
We try to respect the writer. I mean, we do believe that one of the most important things is that the work is good. But we try to communicate that with our writers at the beginning, you know, what the process is, and so it's very transparent to the writer. But like any publication, we've stepped on people's toes. Writers and artists, we put our life, our heart, and our ego into our work, and so it would be naive or stupid to say that we don't sometimes have hurt feelings. Our own feelings as writers, you know, within the collective, when our comrades are criticizing our work, that can, you know, result in bruised egos, and the same with our writers and artists that contribute. Certainly there have been, you know, hurt feelings from time to time, but we try to be really transparent that it's what the process is, and that no one is immune to that process. There's no one who's above the editorial collective. You know, that everyone goes through a revision, usually at least one revision of any work. Rarely any time a first draft would ever be published, and I think that's just good. That's just good, solid writing practice. Any writer who's writing nonfiction for publication, who thinks that his or her work does not need to be revised as a writer, I think who is sort of insulated and immune and kind of ignorant of what writing and publishing is about, because you only want the best work to be published, and that's ultimately what the goal is the best work that the reader will read.
Okay, so you come out quarterly. Where can folks find Fifth Estate?
We're widely distributed in mainstream bookstores by Ingram Periodicals, and so if you're not getting Fifth Estate in your local store, you can ask your bookseller to order it. It's fairly easy to get from Ingram or other mainstream periodical distributors, but also, of course, subscriptions, and that would be the best way for a person to support the magazine. It's quite affordable, $10 a year, you get 4 issues. That's just, you know, the price of a beer and a movie or something. So we encourage people to subscribe for $10. We have a presence online, but we're really print-based. We don't put a lot of content, at least right now. Maybe a later date that will change, at fifthestate.org. And then we're reachable by email at fifthestate@pumpkinhollow.net. And our mailing address is quite simple as well. It's just Box 6, Liberty, Tennessee, 37095.
If you don't mind, I have one quick question about working with Ingram, since it is sort of this big, the Goliath of the magazine industry. How is it working with them? I mean, what are the pluses and minuses of going that route, since it is
somewhat
unusual?
They get the magazines into the stores, and I think that's important if you want to have a magazine that you need to reach people, and we want to reach outside of our little usual suspects. We want to reach beyond. I mean, if our goal truly is to change society and not just to publish a successful magazine, you have to consider that to a certain extent. We want to break even and make our bills. Being with Ingram isn't really about profit, because we don't make that much money. They make the money, and they, you know, they do a lot of the work to get it out in the stores, and that's why they, don't pay, you know, the publisher that much. The reason we work with them is to get the ideas out there beyond just the usual peripheries that we would find Fifth Estate in, like the independent and the radical bookstores. That network is fairly small. We'd like to see Fifth Estate available in every major metropolitan area in some kind of a bookstore. I don't think that's a bad thing, but you have to make compromises. I think that that generally speaking, though, that they're good for getting the magazine out there. They're not good for for the small publisher to make money. But distribution, bookstore sales have never been good for that. I mean, because you think about the matrix that's involved in terms of shipping it, you know, via the postal service or UPS. Think about all the people that are employed by these companies. You think about the bookstores themselves. I mean, you know, it's, you know, bottom line, so much human labor has gone into, you know, to getting a $3 magazine into the hands of a consumer. I think it's actually naive for a small publisher to think that bookstore sales are where it's at. Bread and butter for your small publishers' subscriptions. And hopefully that readers, you know, who pick up a magazine in a bookstore will subscribe, hopefully.
Cool. Well, once again, thanks again.
Sure, thank you.
And now, Sunfrog is part of the editing collective of Fifth Estate Magazine.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.